I would suggest that the militaries talking to each other is even preferable than the diplomats and even the politicians.
South Korea says it is open to summit talks with North Korea. It's Thursday, January 11th. This is VOA Asia. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We're on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, a key communications link is again open in Korea. Calls mount for the release of journalists in Myanmar. Aviation sinks the altitude of China-Taiwan relations. Child obesity grows. Power from windows. It's all on today's VOA Asia. South Korean President Moon Jae-in, a day after the North and South met in the first high-level talks in more than 2 years, said he is open to a summit with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. While facing reporters on Wednesday, Mr. Moon said he is open to any form of meeting under the right conditions, but it shouldn't be talks for the sake of talks. He also gave credit to President Donald Trump for helping to bring about the conditions that permitted the talks in the truce village of Panmunjom to occur. That meeting resulted in the North's announcement it will participate in next month's Winter Olympic Games in South Korea and reestablish a military hotline with Seoul. The two sides may also meet for military talks to avoid any miscalculations. The United States said Tuesday's talks was a positive development, but the State Department insisted that the North's participation in the games does not violate UN Security Council sanctions over its nuclear and missile programs. Sarah Huckabee Sanders is a White House spokeswoman.
Certainly the next steps would be denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula is our number one priority and certainly what we would like to see. We are in very close contacts with our South Korean allies about these conversations. The president spoke with Moon over the weekend. I don't believe they've spoken since then, but I know officials from our administration have been in touch with officials from the South Korean side.
Troy Stangarone of the Washington-based Korea Economic Institute tells VOA's Victor Beatty the thaw in Korean relations is a positive development, but urged caution.
Right now, there's still some technical details to be worked out, so things could change potentially depending on how the North Koreans respond to whatever restrictions may be placed on them or any requests they make that South Korea is unwilling to fulfill. So we should be cautiously optimistic, I think, at this point. But we also need to consider that many people are trying to perhaps put more weight on these talks than we should. This is about trying to take and change the dynamic. It's about hoping to take and have a successful Olympics. Anything that goes beyond that, I think we should be more cautious about right now.
The South Koreans indicated that they hope this is the beginning of a long process that will ultimately lead to a lessening of nuclear tensions. Is that possible?
It'll depend on North Korea's behavior. Right now, there's been no explicit statement of what North Korea's participation entails in terms of North Korea refraining from conducting tests during this period. While one could argue that there is a tacit understanding of that, because should they conduct a test before the Olympics or during the Olympics, that would clearly undermine the spirit of this agreement and also undermine confidence in dealing with North Korea. The real test will become right after the Olympics. Exercises were delayed to the beginning of April. There's a very good chance North Korea may choose that as an opportunity to take and conduct another test. If they do refrain, though, then that might create more space, but we'll really have to see.
Grant Newsham, a senior research fellow at the Tokyo-based Japan Forum for Strategic Studies, also urged caution about North Korea's intentions, insisting its goal is reunification of the two Koreas on North Korea's terms.
That said, it's always a good thing, I think, especially when the militaries talk to each other or have some sort of communication. I would suggest that the militaries talking to each other is even preferable than the sort of the diplomats and even the politicians talking to each other.
The chief of the North Korean delegation, Ri Song-gwan, said something remarkable. He said all our weapons, including atomic bombs, hydrogen bombs, and ballistic missiles, are only aimed at the U.S., not at South Korea, China, or Russia. Was that a surprising announcement?
Not really. You'll notice he appears not to have mentioned Japan. It's intended to sort of sow doubt, ideally split relationships. It has a very definite meaning, and the idea is to continue to sow doubt in that part of the South Korean population that does think a deal can be reached with North Korea if they just talk about it and somehow that the two countries can get back together and bring the Korean people back together. If allowed to fester or continue to its logical extent, you just might find that the South Korean apologists, the sympathizers, putting it uncharitably, the useful idiots, just might be able to, over time, create some distance between South Korea and the United States, which ultimately is North Korea's objective, in my opinion.
At his Wednesday news conference, President Moon said Tuesday's talks were only the beginning, a first step, and a good start. Bringing North Korea to denuclearization talks, he added, is the next step to take. These are among some of the top Asia stories trending on VOAnews.com. Trump to South Korea. U.S. open to talks with North at appropriate time. China and Asia leaders discuss Mekong Dam projects. Indonesia moves forward on plans to relocate capital. Pakistani mob angered by rape, murder of girl, attacks police. UNICEF says Myanmar's Rohingya children trapped, deprived, forgotten. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on Facebook at VOA Asia. And as always, you can stop by the VOAnews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Amid the recent talks with South Korea, Pyongyang has also reopened a communications link with the South for the first time in nearly 2 years. James Kim is a research fellow at the Seoul-based Asan Institute for Policy Studies. He was asked by VOA's Victor Beatty if the reopening of a cross-border Korean communications link is a significant development.
It depends what you mean by significant. If you mean significant in the sense that the North Koreans are willing to now talk about denuclearization, I'm highly skeptical about that possibility. But if it's significant in terms of progressing towards thawing of relations and looking for areas of possible cooperation, this is a significant development in that regard.
The U.S. has indicated that high-level talks between the two Koreas is fine with them, but they don't expect much to come out of it. What is the view there in South Korea?
I think the view is very similar here, that there's actually even more concern, I believe, that if the North Korean side makes demands that the South Korean government cannot uphold or even accept, then Seoul would be put in a very difficult position. But in terms of the expectation about what the talks will be about, the government is keeping a very open mind and trying to use this as sort of a stepping stone for other things that they could talk about, for instance, the separated families meeting, possible humanitarian assistance, and possible even economic cooperation of some sort. But beyond that, on matters dealing with denuclearization, I think the government is keeping a very level head and a very realistic expectation that this is not something that's going to get solved overnight.
There's a concern expressed by the UN U.S. Ambassador Nikki Haley that the North is about to test launch another ballistic missile. What's the view there?
It wouldn't be surprising at all that North Korea uses or thinks about provocation in the same way that they think about talks. That is, these are all signals or means of communication that North Korea uses in order to elicit certain kind of response they would like from the other side, whether that is South Korea or the United States or the international community. And so we would not be surprised at all if these kinds of overtures were coupled with another test of some kind. And the question would, again, be for the Seoul government here, the Moon administration, is whether to move ahead with the talks and to try to keep the mood in a sort of a more warm set rather than trying to go back to the way things were before Kim Jong-un's last New Year speech.
James Kim, research fellow at the Seoul-based Asan Institute for Policy Studies. Happening now in Asia, two Reuters journalists jailed in Myanmar have been formally charged with violating the country's Official Secrets Act. The case has sparked international condemnation and calls for their immediate release amid the continuing Rohingya crisis. Stay up to date online with VOA 60. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad to have you with us on this Thursday morning at VOA Asia. Prosecutors in Myanmar, also known as Burma, have filed charges against two journalists working for Reuters under the Official Secrets Act that could land them in jail for up to 14 years. The act dates to 1923 and the British colonial era, and it covers entering prohibited areas and taking images or handling of official documents that might help the enemy. The two reporters, Hua Lone and Kyo So-woo, were detained last month after being invited to dinner by police and handed some documents. They had been covering the security crackdown in western Rakhine State that forced hundreds of thousands of Rohingya Muslims to flee to Bangladesh. Hua Lone said the charges are unacceptable, and he said they are charging us to stop us from finding the truth. Their actions are wrong and unjust. Francis Wade, a London-based freelance journalist and author of Myanmar's Enemy Within, tells VOA it appears the two journalists were victims of a sting operation, in which police launch a deceptive operation to catch someone committing a crime.
From what we know of past media reporting on the issue, it seems that they were passed information or evidence of mass graves in northern Rakhine State, where recent military attacks against the Rohingya minority have occurred. And it seems to be an effort to disappear the source of the leaks, or at least the people who have taken care of these documents provided by villagers in northern Rakhine State that would indicate military assaults on Rohingya, and essentially gain control of the narrative. The government and the military feel that their position is being challenged by media reporting on the subject. They've produced a narrative of defense against Rohingya insurgents, what the international media and some local media are saying that this is an act of aggression, it's an act of ethnic cleansing. So the government and the military are essentially seeking to gain control of that narrative.
Amid much media coverage, former U.S. President Bill Clinton has said the two reporters should be released immediately, but Francis Wade is not optimistic outside pressure will have an effect.
It seems to be part of a trend of declining press freedom in Myanmar. They're certainly not the first journalist to be arrested in the last few months. In October, journalists from TRT World, the Turkish broadcaster, were jailed for 2 months for flying a drone over parliament. Particularly when it comes to the crisis in Rakhine State, there's a real sensitivity around the issue, given the portrayals that it's received in international media. And certainly the government and the military know that by arresting journalists, they will be sending a message to other journalists that certain areas are off bounds when it comes to reporting.
The case adds to an already bad year for Myanmar counselor Aung San Suu Kyi, who has been harshly criticized for not doing more to deal with the Rohingya crisis.
She appears to have taken a position of acquiescence with the military in its attacks on Rohingya. She's essentially beholden to a very powerful Buddhist nationalist lobby. That means she appears unwilling or incapable of speaking out in defense of the Rohingya and against military aggression there. I think this year will be crucial to her in terms of her international standing. What she appears to be doing is seeking to ensure that she retains domestic support. That seems to be a priority at the moment, and to avoid antagonizing the military.
Francis Wade said, tragically, it appears that efforts at reform in Myanmar have also unleashed animosities toward minority groups in what he called this ethnically fissured nation. He said journalists, rights activists, and academics have been documenting the deterioration of conditions in Rakhine State since the democratic transition began 5 years ago, making the crackdown by security forces since last August likely. You're listening to VOA Asia.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
This news alert from VOA Asia. Malaysia's government has signed a deal with an American firm to resume the search for flight MH370 almost 4 years after the plane disappeared. The Boeing 777 vanished with 227 passengers and 12 crew members. Only small pieces of debris have washed up on beaches and been recovered. Visit VOA 60 for more on this and other stories, along with VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, Taiwan's high-level protest to China against a declaration of new civilian flight paths in the contested strait between them is now taking relations to a new low. President Tsai Ing-wen in Taipei called a National Security Council meeting Sunday after China opened four routes near Taiwan without notifying her government and began letting civilian aircraft use them that same day. Taiwan's foreign ministry says Beijing's move violates the results of talks between air transport associations from both sides in March of 2015. Analysts and politicians suspect China knew Taiwan would object and open the flight paths to continue a 2-year course of increasing political pressure on Tsai's government. Raymond Wu is managing director of Taipei-based political risk consultancy eTelligence.
This is something that China did unilaterally. It wasn't something that was done through negotiation. It wasn't something that people talked about or reached a compromise or consensus on.
Taiwanese officials are likely to see the start of new flight routes as another milestone in mounting political pressure from China. And some experts believe Beijing wants to make Taiwan feel the impact of Tsai's refusal to talk on the One China condition. Tsai said Sunday that Taiwan would increase national security and communicate fully with the international community as China's flight path activations severely influenced regional security and flight safety. Over the past 2 years, Beijing has passed an aircraft carrier and military planes around Taiwan. Taiwan's ruling party lawmaker Lo Chin-shen says other countries may be preoccupied with the future of North Korea, and China is not likely to answer any direct pleas from Taiwan.
We definitely need to respond very strongly to this unilateral change to the status quo. But obviously, China will not respond to any calls on the Taiwan side.
China's north-south path falls within a flight information region overseen from Shanghai rather than a military defense zone that would require Taiwan to notify China of its own flights. The flight paths that China activated January 4th in the 160-kilometer-wide Taiwan Strait do not force Taiwan to change its own aircraft movements, although flights to outlying islands could encounter more traffic from China. China still hopes to avoid moves that would anger big swaths of the island's public, whose sympathy China considers key to its goal of peaceful unification, according to experts. Our thanks to our resident expert Ralph Jennings in Taipei for contributing this story. This news alert from VOA Asia. French officials say China has ordered 184 Airbus A320 planes to be delivered to 13 airlines as French President Emmanuel Macron wraps up a state visit to the country. The French-built planes are the main rival to American-made Boeing aircraft, which dominate the market. All the big stories come your way through the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, a new study shows there has been a huge increase in the number of obese and overweight children around the world in just a couple of generations. Henry Ridgewell from London tells us one of the biggest epidemiological studies ever undertaken. Scientists have found dramatic transformations in many parts of the world.
The study by the World Health Organization and Imperial College London analyzed height and weight measurements of 130 million people to determine their body mass index, or BMI. The results were stark. In just 4 decades, since 1975, there has been a tenfold increase in childhood and adolescent obesity. It is a global problem. But the most dramatic changes have occurred in middle-income countries in East Asia, the Middle East and North Africa, and Latin America. Lead author, Professor Majid Edzati.
So places that a few decades ago there may have been very little obesity and a fair amount of underweight suddenly are having bordering epidemics.
In higher-income countries, rates of childhood obesity have plateaued but remain very high. In this income group, the United States had the highest obesity rates. Researchers say the global epidemic is a result of food marketing and policy making across the globe.
Rather than sort of being an individual's choice, it's how the environments that people choose their foods, healthy foods being priced out of reach, and especially out of the reach of poor, and unhealthy foods being marketed aggressively, together with perhaps not having the safe playing area for children, that are leading to weight gain.
Obesity is an underlying cause of many diseases later in life, including heart disease, stroke, diabetes, and some cancers. But it also has a big impact in childhood.
So it's associated with the stigma, so psychosocial consequences for the children. There is some evidence that it actually affects educational outcome of the children.
The study also looked at the number of underweight children, which still represents a major health challenge, especially in the poorest parts of the world. India had the highest prevalence of moderately and severely underweight young people.
We really need to deal with the two issues at the same time. So we can't wait to deal with underweight and then worry about overweight and obesity. The transition happens really fast, and they are all different forms of malnutrition.
The report's authors are calling for policymakers to find ways to make healthy, nutritious food more available at home and school, especially in poorer families and communities, alongside higher taxes on unhealthy foods. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
And as with many of our stories, there's great video with Henry's story. You can see that at voanews.com and at VOA Asia Facebook. The sunshine is also something usually good to see. And now solar power is definitely the wave of the future. But in the future, instead of having perhaps a roof covered with solar panels, VOA's Kevin Enix has found out that your own windows may be collecting power from the sun and helping your home conserve energy.
This is the bright idea behind some new solar tech that could change the way your windows work.
And if they all lie flat, the fluorescent dye molecules will absorb sunlight and redirect it to the edges of your glass. And if you have solar panels on the edge of your glass, you can use it to generate electricity. And if you turn on the power, the fluorescent dye molecules will stand upright, like liquid crystals, and that will leave the sunlight to go through unharmed.
In the summer, this glass will block harmful ultraviolet rays and also keep radiant heat out of your house, like blinds. In the winter, they turn transparent and let sunlight keep homes warm. But they can also work as solar panels, say Dutch researchers.
This is a luminescent solar concentrator. It's a sheet of plastic that contains a very bright fluorescent dye molecule. The idea is to be able to use these devices to replace normal silicon solar panels in areas of the built environment. So it would simplify integration into buildings or as a sound barrier or as a bus stop.
The idea is that any piece of glass in the future will not only protect you from the elements, but also be see-through solar panels.
So, to our knowledge, the liquid crystal-based windows are the only solution at the moment that remain this transparency. We don't affect the visible light.
The Dutch research team admits they do not work as well as normal solar panels, but they are better than nothing in areas that do not get a lot of direct sunlight.
In an area that you have a very small, confined area, with good solar access, you'll want to use a silicon solar panel. They're the most efficient available. But everywhere else, somewhere, for example, in a shaded area or on the north wall of a building or an area that's going to have a lot of human traffic, for example, this can take the impact of a child's football.
The team says they are already working with commercial partners to get the windows onto the market. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. Our program is found on iTunes and SoundCloud and also great radio stations across Asia, like Helps Radio at Help University in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia. And if you happen to see the Faculty of Communication who run the radio station, say hello to them. We say hello and thank you to our director, Tracy Carter, engineer, Dave Magnus, managing editor, Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team, including Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, and David Bird. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a wonderful day ahead.